I decided, since I was invited to this conference, to give a talk that was never given before. So these slides were made for the first time. Neither of the two authors ever discussed this paper before. So it's a good opportunity for you to find a big bug in the main result, right? Or on the other hand, since none of you heard, you know, any of this before, most likely, I really encourage you to ask questions and make comments and so on and so forth. Okay, so that's the goal. So it's a joint work with Perostin, who's sitting there. And let me start. So I keep changing the title. I'm not sure that this is the really the appropriate title, but we'll see as we go along. So I'm going to sort of jump into a technical topic, and I'm not going to motivate it so much because you're supposed to know what the motivation is. And the basic idea is that there are certain kind of tests, or more specifically non-code tests, that play an important role in studying hardness of approximation, in particular hardness of approximation of constraints of a function problem or predicates that are associated with them. So at a very high level, I'm going to be a little bit more technical later. Long code test analysis is basically based in the following way. You have some predicate Q. There's some interesting joint distribution that you cook over inputs, which are typically vectors x1 to xk. And what you want to understand is you want to understand for which functions of these vectors f1 to fk the predicate is satisfied or unsatisfied with good probability when applied to the functions of these vectors. Okay, so if you haven't seen it before, this may be a little surprising. And actually, what we'll actually talk about in this talk, we'll talk about what can you say about quantities like that. Okay, and this is everything that I'm going to say about PCP. There's going to be some hints about what might one hope for, or where one uses tests like that in PCPs or in hardness of approximation, but I'm not going to talk about anything about the outside machinery. So somehow, since this is a talk that's sort of experimental, I'm going to do the history completely convoluted. So instead of following the history of the tests as they were developed over time, I'm going to look at it from the outside and say, what kind of tests are there? And then I'm going to ask about properties of them. So those of you who actually know the history, be patient, right? This is not the way the history of this test has been developed, but you know, it will help make the point I want to make. Now, when you look at it from the outside, you may argue that there are two kinds of tests, what I call algebraic or additive tests. And this usually tests some linearity properties or other algebraic property, and they're closely related to algebra or to additive combinatorics. And often these tests are invariant under linear group, under linear changes transformation over the field of two elements or another finite field. There's something else which I would like to call geometric tests. I'm going to give example of these two kinds of tests very soon, which sort of are related to real geometric questions or to Fourier analysis. And often in this test, the coordinates play an important role, and in particular, they are not invariant under linear transformation. And sort of one reason why I want to, I guess this is not what I wanted to do. Okay, can you see the button still? What? Yeah, okay, thanks. Okay. So one constraint was removed. Okay. So the motivation is to sort of understand the relationship between these two types of tests, and maybe to ask if there is some uniform framework or there's some common line between this kind of tests where you can get something new. Okay, so let me give examples. This is very high level, so let me give you some examples. And again, for those of you who actually know the area, these examples are going to be very familiar, and for those of you who don't know the area, you know, this is sort of a soft introduction to what I'm actually going to talk about. So maybe one of the first tests that, you know, came in the context of property testing is what's called the BLR test. Or for those of you who know additive combinatorics, it's closely related to what's called Ross theorem. And the question here, or the question that was asked in the BLR test, is we're looking at a function from -1, 1 to the n to -1, 1, not to the n, to -1, 1. That's a typo over there. And we want to know if this function is linear over the field of two elements, right? So I'm using two representations here of the same function. So the actual function that I'm interested in is maybe function from F2 to the N to F2. So let me call this F tilde. And F is just going to be minus 1 to the F tilde, right? So that's the real representation of this function. That's the usual way we move between real value function and F2 value function. And the distribution that you use in order to apply this test is the following distribution. So I'm going to write the inputs in rows of a matrix. So the rows of the matrix are going to be x1, x2, and x3. And what are the properties of this matrix? So the columns of this matrix are independent. They're actually, and they have the same distribution. So this column is independent of that column, is independent of that column. And they all have the same distribution. And what is the distribution? So if you write it in the minus 1, 1 notation, the distribution is uniform over the bits, the minus 1, 1 value that satisfies the equation, x1j, x2j equal x3j. Or in the parity notation, this just means that the parity of x1 and x2 is x3, or the XOR of x1, x2, x3 is 0. Okay. What we're going to test, we're going to look at the value of the parity of fx1, fx2, fx3. And again, since we're looking at minus 1, 1, we are just looking, going to look at the parity of this, this predicate. Looks familiar? Okay. So I'm going to confuse this slightly and use a different notation for the same test, and this would be useful later when we consider a more general test. So the way I want to think about this and the way that long code tests often look like is, first of all, there's a small distribution in this case over 3 bits. This is the uniform distribution over 3 bits with parity 0. And then I'm going to sample, and again, this is the same notation is used, but it's for different objects. I'm going to sample x1, x2, x3 from u to the n. When I write mu to the n, I mean this matrix. So mu, this distribution mu, just means one column of the matrix. And when I write mu to the n, I mean n columns of this matrix. And x1, x2, and x3 are the rows of this matrix. Okay. It's a little, it may be look a little unnatural, but that's the way you, that's the thing that you always do in sort of long code tests. You define a product distribution, you define a distribution over columns, then you take many columns, and the functions actually are applied to the rows of the matrix. Okay? Okay. Okay, so let's remind briefly what's happening for this test. So we want to know if it's linear. We are going to sample and test fx1, fx2, fx3. Then you do the analysis. What does the analysis mean? We want to know what's the expected value of the test. So this is a very beautiful Fourier formulation. So if you write the expected value of fx1, fx2, fx3, you expand it. I'm not going to expand it. It's easy to expand it. You get the sum of the cubed of the Fourier coefficient. In particular, it's 1 if f is linear. Linear means that there's only one Fourier coefficient that's non-zero and its value is 1. And in general, if you look at the absolute value of this quantity, then, again, it's the sum of the cubed of the Fourier coefficients. The sum of the square of the Fourier coefficients is 1. So this is less than the maximum of all Fourier coefficients of the Fourier coefficients. And what you get from this analysis is that if you pass the test in bias epsilon, then you have epsilon correlation with an affine function. Not necessarily a linear function, but an affine function. That's sort of the analysis of the BLR test, and like I said before, that's the same analysis that Frost used when he proved his theory. Questions so far? Okay. So let's do another example of an algebraic test or an additive test. This is sort of the Gauer's analysis. He has a poster here on the wall. He probably talked about it in the Fields Institute a few years ago. We want to know how do functions f1 of k distinguish arithmetic progressions, and the test is going to be a similar test. Again, now we are going to look at arithmetic progressions. So we are going to look at arithmetic progressions in, say, Vp to the n. Okay, so we're looking at a vector space, which is just Vp to the power n. And the distribution that we're going to take is the uniform distribution over arithmetic progression in Vp. So x1 and up to xk is just going to be a uniformly chosen arithmetic progression. If you think about it for a second, If you look at mu to the n, it defines a uniform arithmetic progression over vp to the n. And the test, you somehow want to test how do fi interact with arithmetic progression. So again, you're going to look at the expected value of the product of the fi, where it's not written here, but f1 is applied to x1, f2 is applied to x2, up to fk is applied to xk. Okay. So yeah, you have to make some decisions. I don't know what decisions do you want to make, but you can think about fi mapping zp to the n to say it's 0, 1, or minus 1, 1. Okay, you can set it even to be complex, but for now, I suppose you just want to understand sets, so you just look at indicators of events, or you do the minus 1, 1 notation. For some reason, you want the expected value to be 0 or whatever. Yes? Right, so somehow you want, so yeah, so what do I mean by that? What you're actually interested usually in situations like that, you're interested, so when I write distinguishing, that's a good question. What do I mean by that? I mean that the expected value of the product, say, of fi xi is very different, so not just not equal, really different than the product of the expected value of the fi. Okay, so here the expected value is the product inside, and here it's the product of the marginal distribution. Right, so this is what would be if you would apply the function f1 to fk to completely random vectors x1 to xk. If instead of applying them to completely random vectors x1 to xk, you apply them to this arithmetic progression, you want the results to be different or not different. Right, so this is what you're testing here. Can your function f1 to fk say that this is arithmetic progression and not the product distribution? Okay. And what does the Gower's analysis give? So the analysis of Gower's gives that one of the things that it gives that if you look at the expected value of the product, it's less or equal than the minimum from 1 to k of the case Gower's norm of fi. Okay. So what is the case Gower's norm of fi? I'm not going to tell you. This is related to additive combinatorics, and I don't want to jump too much into it. But what this is telling you is it's telling you that some sort of functions with low Gower's norms, cannot distinguish arithmetic progressions from the product distribution. Okay, so there is a way of measuring if a function is sort of smooth in arithmetic sense, and if at least one of the functions is smooth in arithmetic sense, then this product cannot distinguish arithmetic progression from the product distribution. I can write a definition of the Gower's norms, but it's not going to help, right? You look at the definition, it's not clear how it's related to that. Okay, so these are two examples of algebraic tests. I'll mention, you know, in a little bit what's the relation to hardness of approximation. Let me give you two examples of geometric tests. Again, I'm not doing the history in the right way. So this is what I call the Cotes test. This is what we've seen yesterday. So this is something that maybe you're even more familiar with. The question here is the following. You want to know where the function. The function is from minus 1, 1 to the n to minus 1, 1, and we want to know if it has a large influence variable. And Cotes test is the following. You look at the distribution over two variables, where each of the bits is unbiased, minus 1, 1 with probability 1 half, and the correlation is rho. And you're going to sample two vectors, x1 and x2, from u to the n. In other words, x1 is just a uniform vector, x2 you flip each bit with probability 1 minus rho over 2. What you're going to test, you're going to test if fx1 is equal to fx2 or the product of fx1 and fx2. So it was mentioned yesterday, so the analysis of KKMO and Mu gives the following. It says, take a function from r to minus 1, 1 that has the same expected value as f. Now you take two normal variables which are standard, but have correlation or covariance rho. Then, if the expected value of fx1, fx2 is greater than the expected value of gn1, gn2, then you know that f has a large influence variable. Okay, so this is the geometric test. Why is it geometric? Because, you know, we are trying to study this object, and somehow the test, both in the formulation, if you want to think about it, it tests some two points that have some correlation between them in the discrete cube, And in the analysis, it has some geometry, because what you actually compare with, you compare with a function that lives in Gaussian space, and you compare to the Gaussian correlation, and the conclusion holds if and only if something you're doing better than what happens in the Gaussian world. Still familiar? Okay. So I generalized this test a little bit, and this was also, I think, mentioned yesterday. Now we have a collection of functions. We want to know if one of them has large influence. We like take some general support distribution of minus 1, 1 to the k. So this is some general distribution over k bits. We sample x1 to xk from u to the n, and we look at the predicate applied to f1, x1 up to fk, xk. And then similar analysis gives you the following. It's a little bit more complicated. Now we're going to look at k functions that have the same expected value as the function f. We're going to look at k-dimensional Gaussian vector that has the same two moments as the distribution, the general distribution of mu that we are looking at. And we're saying, if what you do in the binary world exceeds the maximum possible result that you can get in the Gaussian world, then one of these variables must have, one of these functions must have a large influence variable. With this maximum? This maximum is taking over all functions that satisfy this property. And our minus 1, 1 values. So this is a generalization of that result. And again, it has a geometric flavor, both in terms of the test that you choose, you know, you choose this general distribution with correlation, but more importantly, what you compare with is you compare with the best Gaussian answer. I mean, well, right. So, you know, this is not really mathematics, right? There's a greater here, and there's a large here, okay? So the large and the greater are related to one another somehow, right? So if this is greater by epsilon, then this is larger by delta, okay? Or you can do it the other way around. Right? So there's a relationship between these two parameters. I'm slightly informally right, but definitely there's a relationship between how much greater you are and how much large this is, right? So that's exactly the point. And the other point is that these claims are sort of dimension independent, right? So, the results hold, you know, there's nothing about n in the statement of these results. Yeah, good point. Okay, so again, this was more reviewing sort of the general framework of what we're looking at. And again, let me try to make the point a little sharper. So somehow, when we look at the first two tests and we look at the distribution that they were sitting on, the distribution had small support. Like even in the BLR test, what do you want? You wanted x1, x2, x3, such that x3 is the parity of x1 and x2. So in each coordinate, we just get half of the possible three values. And in n coordinates, we get half of the n of the a to the n possible values. Right? So the support is very small. And the geometric test, the two tests that I described, the Subash test and the more general test, we look at general product distribution, which typically have to have full support. The conclusions are also different. In the arithmetic test, the results are often of the form correlation with arithmetic structure, right? So the BLR test told us that the function is a linear function, essentially, or close correlated to a linear function. The Gauss test told us that it has additive structure. The Gauss norm is large, which roughly means that it's correlated with polynomials, not exactly. And the geometric test tells you something completely different. It tells you that it's a high influence variable, right? So it's sort of, you know, there's like, it seems like these two things are quite different. And what we will try to do today is we're going to try to look at a common setup. And in particular, I'm going to show you an example where you can apply the two approaches. And interestingly, the two approaches give similar results. And we're going to look at pairwise independent distribution. So if you think about the arithmetic structures, in the arithmetic structures, it's always pairwise independent distribution. Right? If we look at the BLR test, with x1, x2, x3, such that x3 is the parity of x1 and x2, so every pair of bits is uniformly distributed. For the Gauss test, arithmetic progressions, if you look uniform distribution of arithmetic progression, it's also pairwise independent distribution. And you can also apply geometric test in this setup. There's going to be a discussion about are we going to look at distribution with or without full support, and we're going to ask what do the two approaches give, and can you give something different? Can you get something better? Right, so for cotest it doesn't going to work, but for the generalization of cotest where you can look at k-dimensional distribution, it does make sense, right? So that's Okay, questions? Okay. So of course, you know, I told you that I'm going to shift history a little bit. So there is an example of something that sort of combined the two points of view, and this is Hastert test that was mentioned yesterday. And what happened with Hastert test, so Hastert test, instead of looking at parity, it looks at noisy parity. So we are looking at x1, x2, and x3, such that the parity of them is 0 is probability 1 over 1 plus rho over 2, and 0 is probability 1 minus rho over 2. And again, this defines a distribution of 3 bits. Then we are going to take n 3 vectors of dimension n such that each column has the right distribution, and we're going to do exactly the same test. Okay. What does Hastert analysis give? So in Hastert analysis, we look at the, actually we don't even need this term, but suppose we look at the expected value of the product of fx1, fx2, fx3. So you get a very similar expression to what we got before, which is the sum of the cubes of the Fourier coefficients. But there is a term which is rho to the size of the Fourier coefficient. And what it means that if you pass this test with this good probability, not only you have a large Fourier coefficient, but you have a large Fourier coefficient which lives on a small set. And this means that your function is actually close to a function of a few variables. It's correlated to a function of a few variables. This was very useful, and I guess the reason that Johan was using this in his paper is that this is very useful in the construction of the PCP or in the analysis of the PCP. Okay? So in my view, this test, if you're thinking about something that has both geometric test and algebraic test, this is sort of the first test that has both of them. It's algebraic because it sort of lives on pairwise independent distribution, and you get sort of the Fourier description, which often comes up in additive analysis. And it's geometric in that it actually identifies specific variables. It's telling you it's not only that you have some property that's invariant under all linear actions. Actually, what you're going to end up with is something that depends on a small number of variables, which is what you need in the analysis. And the question that we're going to ask is that, can this kind of test, which both has this geometric flavor and has this algebraic flavor, can be extended? Questions? Okay, so it was extended, so let me mention two extensions, and both of them are actually has to do with pairwise independent distribution. So the first extension was done via the Gauss dome, and this was done by Alex Samordinsky and Luca Trevisan. And then just looked at the following standard construction of the pairwise independent distribution. So you look at y1 to yk is going to be uniform over the k-dimensional cube, over minus 1, 1 to the k. Then you're going to define a much longer vector of length 2 to the k, or actually 2 to the k minus 1, which consists of all parity of subsets of the y. So this is the standard construction of a pairwise independent distribution. And then you're going to sample XS. So again, this is a distribution of K bits. Now we're going to sample a matrix of N times K bits, where there are N columns, each distributed according to this distribution. Sorry, N times 2 to the K bits, or 2 to the K minus 1 bits, all sampled from this distribution. And the test that you're going to look at is the test that we discussed always, which is the expected value of the product minus the product of the expected value. Okay, so what did they prove? So they prove, they used the Gauss norm in the analysis. Again, I won't go into the analysis, but what they proved is they proved that if this test doesn't deviate from showing that, or show the difference between their distribution and the product distribution, then there must be a variable that has a large influence. Actually, there must be two variables that are correlated and so on and so forth. But one of the things that they showed is that they showed that if this deviates, the expected value of the product is different than the product of the expected value, then there must be a large influence variable. Okay? So this is interesting. The setup is algebraic, right? This is some linear subspace that is described here. And the conclusion is of the flavor of the geometric flavor that we've seen before, because it involves influence. And also the analysis is algebraic too. It involves the Gauss norm, right? So there's an interesting mixture of geometric flavor and algebraic flavor in this test. However, the sad news is that the results are weaker than Hastert test, because it's just in terms of influences, and it's not in terms of actual correlation with a small number of variables. And in particular, when you do an analysis like that, you cannot get anything better than unique gains hardness. And this is what they got. They got the unique gains hardness showing up approximate resistance of this predicate that's written there. I have a feeling I'm using an older version of the talk, so let me revert, make it interesting for you. Oh. I think I was using copy one. Okay, so that's the test. That's the test that we've seen now. So, again, if you look at my result from sorry about that, if you look at my result from 0.8, then you can apply them for pairwise independent distribution with full support, and what you get is you get that if the maximal influence is going to zero, then the expected value of the product and the product of the expected value are close to one another. So there are two ways of thinking about it. One way, this is generalization of the result of or the test of Samudnitsky and Pivasan. But the other way to think about it, this construction uses geometry only. There's no additive structure here. In particular, this is a general pairwise independent distribution, but it has this additional property, which is sort of annoying when you look at it, that this distribution has to have a full support. And this was later used by Perrenite in order to prove that pairwise independent predicates are approximation resistant, and then by Per and Johan to show that many predicates, or in a high enough dimension, many predicates are approximation resistant. So, again, what am I aiming to? We are trying to understand some sort of the interplay between algebraic tests and geometric tests. We got sort of almost the same result from this geometric test and algebraic test that Luca and Alex were using under slightly different condition. I need full support, but it's a general distribution. They need some specific distribution. So the question is, what's going on here? And in particular, what we wanted to know when we started working on this is, can we do the following? So the ultimate extension of Hastedt's test would be the following. We're going to look at a general pairwise independent distribution. It wouldn't have to have any algebraic structure. It could just be any pairwise independent distribution. We are going to sample x1 from xk from u to the n. We are going to ask, do the fi distinguish x1 to fk from the product distribution? And if we pass, what we would want is what Astad actually got in his test. And this is not just having a high influence variable, but an actual correlation with a function of a small number of variables. Yes? No. Say again? No, you cannot. What's
the question is, if you got what you hoped for, yeah, would you replace empty hardness with the would you
right. So the reason I give this talk here is that this we sort of know how to prove now. And what's left for you to prove is the NP hardness. Okay, so it's an excellent question, right? So I wouldn't talk about the gadgets that actually prove NP hardness, but I think, there are two steps here, right? There's like the sort of the outer verifier and the long code analysis, right? So what I'm telling you is that we can do the long code analysis, and what you have to think is that you can come up with a good outer verifier that would give you Smodinsky Trevisan and would actually give you NP hardness. Okay, so like you said, there are two pieces to the game, and I'm telling you one of the pieces we know how to do, and the other piece, and the reason I'm giving this talk here is that I want you to do the other piece. Okay, so that's the reason I'm giving this talk. And this is written here in the second box, so you're just reading very quickly. So we would hope to get that, and in terms of hardness, we would want to get NP hardness for all predicates who support the pairwise independent distribution. Okay, so that's sort of the game that we want to play. Excellent questions. Okay, so let me tell you what we know. So I really like to giving this talk, except I had to prepare it. I really like giving this talk here. And the reason is that, you know, Per is here, and I was hoping that Hamed Khatami is also going to be here, but I guess he's not around. So the two results are one is Per, and actually the other one, which is, I think, most useful, is sort of an observation that comes out of this result. Let me tell you what are the results that we can prove. So this is sort of the main theorem, and this is the corollary, and you're much more likely to use the corollary than the result, so I'll start with the result and then I'll tell you the corollary. The proof of the corollary from the result is half a page, and I'm going to show you the proof in a bit. But here's the result. So mu is going to be a general pairwise independent distribution. We are going to do the same game that we played before. We are going to put this in columns. There are going to be n columns. We are going to apply F on the rows of the matrix. And we are going to make an additional assumption that's obviously very annoying if you want to apply this, but we're going to make the assumption that Fi are degree D polynomials. So when you do the Fourier expansion, if you want, the degree in the Fourier expansion is degree D, then you get the following. You get that the expected value of the product is less than some constant to the degree times the maximum Fourier coefficients of F. So when I write I mean the maximum Fourier coefficients, if you want. Okay, so this doesn't have to be just the binary alphabet, it can be any alphabet, but you can think about it this way, this is a fair way to think about it, times the product of the L2 norms. What is it telling you? It's telling you exactly what Hastad test was telling you. It's telling you that in order to pass the test, in order to behave differently than the product distribution, you need to have a large Fourier coefficient. Okay? But this is for the greedy polynomials, unfortunately. Khatami corollary is the following. If mu is given by k distinct noisy linear form, I'll give you a definition or an example of that, what that is in a second, x1 to xk, and if the fi are just bounded functions, they're all say minus 1, 1, then the same conclusion holds. So the expected value of the product is bounded by some function that goes to 0 as the maximum Fourier coefficients of, say, F1 goes to 0. So what Khatami's test is telling you is for this noisy additive predicate, for example, it's the pairwise construction, pairwise independent construction with noise, if you do better than, if you succeed to distinguish the distribution that you see from the product distribution, then you must have a high Fourier coefficient. Right, so you need to make some assumption. You need to make some assumption. Let me just make the assumption. So actually the statement that's written here are true, but let's just make the assumption in order to make it clear in our mind that the F1 is unbiased. Okay, it doesn't actually have to be all of them, but let's just say that F1 is unbiased, the expected value of F1 is 0. Otherwise, actually, you can very easily make statement like that, where instead of looking at this quantity, you look at the expected value of the product minus the product of the expected value, right? So it's just a question of what do you feel more convenient with. Yes, what? Yes. So in particular, one of the things that not written, I should have written, that's a very good point, but actually this is really like a Hastad test. If it's noisy linear form, then it is actually going to be the situation that if you pass, then it must be that all of the functions are correlated with a small number of variables, and in fact what we prove in the paper is actually there are at least three of them that are correlated with the same small set of variables. Okay, so you can extract more information than what I discussed here. I'm just trying to sort of give the easiest result that come, or the more conceptual result that come into the game. Okay? So, and that's exactly the kind of thing that you need in construction of PCPs. It's not enough just to have some coefficient, you need to have small coefficient, and you need to have interaction between them, but you get all of that, right? So it's not just that you get high coefficient. Other questions? Okay, so let's just me explain what do I mean by noisy linear predicate. So maybe the simplest example, and I think maybe the one that's most useful if you actually want to think about doing a PCP. So you look again at the standard pairwise independent construction, which is 2 to the k minus 1 bits that are produced from k bits. And here are two options. Choose whatever you want. In nu, you take nu and flip each bit independently with small probability epsilon. And in the other nu, you take mu and with probability epsilon flip all the bits and put something that's completely random. Okay, so the distribution is just the usual k-was independent distribution plus a little bit of noise. What I'm trying to tell you in this slide is that it doesn't really matter how do you put the noise on. You can put it independently in each bit. You can put the distribution as probability 99%, as probability 1%, just put something random. Probably any other reasonable way that you'd come up with that will have full support will also work, right? So it's like, it doesn't really matter how do you put the noise, you will get the result of Hatami. Okay? And again, the challenge for you, for everybody else is to prove this, to show hardness of approximation based on NP hardness. It's a huge challenge. I can identify the challenge. I know at least 4 people who tried to do it and they all failed. So you know, I'm trying to sell it to you, but it's not, I don't think it's easy, right? So it's like you have to come up with a good construction, right? I mean, you can think about, it's hard for me to say because first of all, I'm not an expert in, you know, constructing auto verifiers, right? And second, you know, you can think about many constructions. And they all, most of them fail, you know, very close to the beginning, and some of them fail a little after the beginning, right? But I don't really know if I can give you something more informative. You really have to think about what's the right, and I don't know, right? So it's like, if you just try to extend Hastert construction, I thought about it a little bit. I couldn't see any way of doing it, for instance. So I don't know how to do it. But it doesn't mean that it's impossible. It just means that you need to think how to do it. Okay, so let me give you some proofs, still have some time. So the proof here is sort of, you know, it's you have to be Hatami in order to come up with the proof because you have to know additive combinatorics. So just, you know, it's a 3-line proof, but, you know, each of these lines requires explanation. One of them is Cauchy-Schwarz. So Cauchy-Schwarz, all of us know. One of them is Sgauer's Cauchy-Schwarz. And in order to know Sgauer's Cauchy-Schwarz is, you don't have to be super smart, but in order for it to sit in your mind, you have to be Hatami. And the other one is that you have to use the theorem of the paper. So let me go over it, over the proof. So again, what we want to prove now is that when we have this noisy linear form, then in order to pass the test with good probability, you actually have to have all of the functions having at least one coefficient that's large. So the analysis is based on this 4 step. One of them is sort of this probabilistic, which either you've seen before or you haven't seen before. But if you're looking at noisy tests, you can assume, instead of looking at noisy tests, you can assume that the Fourier spectrum of all of the functions decay. Because sort of what the noise does for you, it kills all of the high amplitude of the Fourier of the functions. Okay, so there's a little bit of standard proof to do here, but you can just do it. So since the predicate is noisy, you can assume that there is a D that doesn't depend on anything, such that if all the functions are bounded by 1, the weight from degree D on is going to be less than epsilon over 2. Okay, so now you're going to separate. You want to calculate the expected value of the product, so it's the expected value of the high amplitude time plus the expected value of the low amplitude. So the expected value of the high amplitude, since all of these other functions are bounded by 1, you're just going to apply Cauchy-Schwarz. So you get the L2 norm of F1 greater than T, and this is less than epsilon over 2. This is what you wanted. Now comes the second part. So for the second part, if your x1 to xk are linear forms, you can apply what's called the Gauer's Cauchy-Schwarz inequality, which tells you that the expected value of f1 less or equal to d, f2 up to fk, is actually less, we saw this before, it's less than the minimum of the Gauer's norms of each of these functions. In particular, we are going to take the Gauer's norm of f1 less or equal to d. This is the k minus 1 Gauer's norm of f1 less or equal to d. Now, the Gauer's norm itself is a pairwise independent distribution test. So this is another thing that you have to know, but we actually knew when we wrote the paper. So this means that you can apply the result of Perrin and myself for this norm and conclude that this goes to 0 when the maximum Fourier coefficient of f goes to 0. Now, all of these statements, just because Johan is looking skeptical, you can make them in terms of epsilon, delta, and so on and so forth, but I didn't write what those are, right? So we didn't write what quantities are involved in that, but that's the proof of Hatami. Any questions about that? Okay. So let me tell you a little bit about, I don't know if I, Let me tell you a little bit about the proof of this result. So sort of this is the main result of the paper. So if mu is a general pairwise independent distribution, and here instead of the maximum degree, I look at the sum of the degree, it doesn't really matter, it just changes the constant C. If the sum of the degrees of Fi is at most D, then the expected value of the product is at most C to the D times the maximal Fourier coefficient of F1 times the product of the L2 of the function Fi. And this is an analysis proof. Do you want to see it, or should I just go to the open problems? Raise your hand if you want to see it. Is this a majority? I don't know. Okay, I'll show you. What's nice about the proof is that there's nothing in the proof. You don't do anything and you get the result. Okay, so this kind of, you know, you have to believe in the result and then you get it. And the philosophy is that you prove it by induction on the number of variables. And somehow the analysis comes in showing that pairwise independent kills some second order terms, and you know, some second order terms vanish, you're okay. That's the philosophy. I can show you in two or three more slides how does it actually work. And you know, since it's an induction, you have to start with something. So you look, start at the case where there are no variables. There's no variables, all the functions are constant. And then the norm of the functions is also the same constant, and the maximum Fourier coefficient is also this constant, so you can actually just take C equal 1 and you're happy and everything is okay. Right? So that's the base of the induction. Okay, so that's very easy. So what is the induction step? In the induction step, you know, since you do induction on the number of variables, I'm just doing it in the case of a minus 1, 1 valued function and the product measure, just because it's simpler. So we write each function as the first variable times some other function of degree 1 lower, plus hi, where hi is a function of, let me write what I'm doing here. Yes. Yeah, sure. Right, so if let's that's a good question. So let's think about it together. So suppose it's the product distribution. So the expected value of the product is the product of the expected value. Let's just do this case, right? So then the expected value of the product, the completely independent, so this is the product of the expected value. Right? So if you want, it's the product, if for the kind of function that we're looking at, it's the product of the empty Fourier coefficient. No, we don't, but this is, actually in this statement we don't. So in particular, it's smaller, let's just separate it. It's smaller than F1 empty set, I just took it out, from the product of the other one, the L2 norm. Right, so it's fine, right? So it's a good question, but you know, this is sort of mechanical to verify, right? So there's nothing complicated. Okay, so what do we actually do in the proof? So in the proof we write F as X one I. So this is sort of a way of writing it's X I, but it's X one, but with respect to the I coordinate of the distribution times gi plus hi. And what's nice is both of these functions are functions of the other variables, x2 up to xn. So we can apply the induction hypothesis to them. And also the degree of g is one less than the degree of f. Okay, because we took a one variable. Okay, and then we write it down. So we have the expected value of the product. It's the sum over partition of where we take G and when we take H. When we take G, we have the product over INT of X1I, the product over INT of the expected of GI, right? This function involves the first variables, this function does not involve the first variables. And then for the I is not in theory just of the expected value of the products of the age. Where does the pairwise independent come into the game? The pairwise independent comes into the game by observing that when we look at this term, this is a product of I in T x1 I. So if the set is of size 1, then this is going to be 0 because it's, you know, just unbiased. If the set is of size 2, since it's of size 2 and it's pairwise independent, it's also be like the point, it's also going to be 0. So what we're going to be left with is in terms of size either 0 or 3 or more. Okay? So let me just do a very rough analysis and use the induction hypothesis. So what do we get for set of size 0? For the set of size 0, we get the expected value of the product of the HI. For this, I'm just going to apply the induction hypothesis. So instead of the expected value of the product of the HI, I'm writing C to the D times delta, which I didn't tell you what delta is. Delta is going to be the maximum. Times delta times the product of the L2 norms of the HI. That's fine. Now for the other terms, how many terms are there? Well, there are at most 2 to the k terms, depending if I'm taking H or G. Each of them, since I lost for each application of G, I lost at least 1 in a degree, I can apply the induction hypothesis with degree 3 lower, so I get 3 to the D minus 3, times delta, times the same product that we need to get. So the maximum over all sets of the product, this guy's a G and this guy's an H. So I'm just expanding, and for each term, I'm using the induction hypothesis. Yes, we go. Here, this was just to check if you're following. Yes. So you're right. It should be together, but it doesn't matter. Yeah, it doesn't matter. Yeah, yeah. The induction work. It doesn't matter. Right. Okay. Good. So now, what do you need in order to prove the thing by induction? Well, what you want to show is that you want to show that this is less than C to the D times delta times the product of the L2 norms of the FI. What you have here is almost of the right form, except you have some annoyances. So first of all, you have C to the D times delta here, and you have C to the D times delta here. Now, so let's take it out. You also lose 2 to the K here, and you gain 3 over C to the cube here. So this is 2 to the K times C to the minus 3. And then, oh God, I did it the other way. Okay? And then, you know, you have either terms that are HI or GI. So what do you need to show? So this should be an HI, unfortunately, and this should be a GI, unfortunately, but what can you do? You know, this is what happens when you give the talk for the first time. So what you need to show is you need to show, you take all of the common terms out, and what you need to show is you need to show that for every set of size at least 2, since we don't include the 1, before it was 3, but now since we don't include the 1, you need to show that the product over INT of HI2 plus 2 to the K over 3 cubed, the product on I not in T GI is less than the product of I in T FI in the second norm. This is an inequality you have to prove. And what's nice about this inequality has nothing to do with functions or norms or anything. This is just an inequality about numbers. So it actually follows from the following inequality. If I is greater or equal than 2, and AI and BI are a bunch of numbers, then there exists an epsilon such that the product of the AI plus epsilon times the product of the BI is less than the product from 1 to R of the L2 norms of the AIs and the BI. And if this calculus exercise is too hard for you on a Saturday morning, divide everything by the product of the AI. What you need to prove is the following. If R is greater or equal than 2, and XI are positive, then there exists an epsilon that depends only on R, such that 1 plus epsilon product of the XI is less than this product. This is calculus. Hopefully you can do it, you know, and you get the result. What's interesting, it's not true if R is equal to 1. Okay? And this is another place where the pairwise independence comes into the game. R has to be at least 2 for this inequality to hold. Okay? So that's the proof. Okay, so, you know, we won't do the exercises now. Let me just end with one comment on a few open questions. So one natural thing to ask, if you like invariants, is to ask, can you actually get something stronger than that? So say in the case where all of the polynomials have low degree, or we look at this noisy linear predicate, Is it true that if all the coefficients of all the functions are small, it's not only that the expected value of the products is like the product of the expected value, it's actually true that the joint distribution of the F is like the product joint distribution. This sounds like a very similar question, and unfortunately, while the previous answer question is a positive answer, this is a negative answer. Here's an example. Let's look at this function, the degree 2 function, it's x1 plus 1, plus the normalized average of all the other variables. Let's look at the BLR distribution, or the simplest pairwise independent distribution, where x3 is the parity of x2 and x1. So what's the property of this function? This function is probability, if x1 is minus 1, then this function is going to be 0. And otherwise, it's behaved like a Gaussian. Okay? If x1 is minus 1, this vanishes. X1 is 1, then this is 2 times a Gaussian, so it behaves like a Gaussian. Now, if you look at the pairwise independent distribution, at least one of the coordinates has to have x1 equal to minus 1. And since that's the case, if you look at the joint distribution of fx1, fx2, fx3, it's going to be supported on bits where at least one of the bits is always going to be 0. However, if you just look at the product distribution, there's a probability about 1/8 that is going to just be looking like 3 independent Gaussian numbers that are non-zero. Okay? So you don't get invariance, you do get that the expected value of the products behave like the product of the expected value. Right, exactly. So there is a relationship. Of course, there is a relationship here between the degree and the degree of independence. Okay, so open problem one. The reason I gave this talk: please prove NP-hardness version of the Trivason and Samodinsky result. I have other questions which are sort of unrelated, so let me just stop here and take questions. Thank you.